heard a single shot last night. No matter that these men had been criminals and killers, no matter that once before they'd wiped out two entire families, I could not absolve myself of their deaths. By omission or commission, my hand was in it, and I would carry it inside me for the rest of my life in a place that I would eventually learn to live with, but never learn to like. Fiona arrived at 11:50 to open the bookstore. By mid-afternoon, the day had turned overcast, drizzly, and cold, so I flipped on the gas logs in the fireplace in the rear conversation area, curled up with some fashion magazines, and watched the customers come and go, wondering what kind of lives they had and why I couldn't have one like that, too. Fiona chatted brightly with everyone but me and rang up orders until 8 o'clock on the dot, when she locked up the store and left. Mere hours after its urbane owner had killed 16 men, all was business as usual at Barron's Books and Baubles again, which begged the question, who was the stone-colder killer, the overzealous ex-boxer-turned-mobster, or the car-collecting bookstore owner? The mobster was dead. The very much alive bookstore owner stepped in from the rain, a little later than usual but no worse for the wear, at 9:30 that night. After relocking the front door, he stopped at the cash register to check on notes Fiona had left him about two special orders placed that day, then joined me, taking an armchair opposite my perch on the sofa. His blood-red silk shirt was splattered with rain and molded to his hard body like a damp second skin. Black trousers clung to his long, muscular legs, and he was wearing black boots that had wicked-looking silver toes and heels. He had on that heavy silver Celtic wrist cuff again that made me think of arcane chants and ancient stone circles, complemented by a black and silver torque at his throat. He radiated his usual absurd amount of energy and dark, carnal heat. I looked him straight in the eye, and he gazed straight back at me, and neither of us said a word. He didn't say, I'm sure you saw the cars out back, Miss Lane, and I didn't say, you cold-blooded bastard, how could you? And he didn't counter with, you're alive, aren't you? So I didn't remind him that he'd been the one to jeopardize my life to begin with. I have no idea how long we sat there like that, but we had a complete conversation with our eyes. There was knowledge in Jericho Barron's gaze, a bottomless pit of it. In fact, for a moment, I imagined I saw the tree itself in there, smothered with delicious shiny red apples just begging to be eaten. But it was only a reflection of flames and crimson silk on irises so dark they served as a black mirror. There was one thing we hadn't covered in our wordless communique that I just had to know. Did you even think twice, Barron's? Did you feel any hesitation at all? When he didn't answer, I pressed. For just a few moments, did you wonder about their families, or worry that maybe one of them was a last-minute substitute who'd never done anything worse in his life than steal some kid's lunch in fourth grade? If eyes were daggers, mine would have killed. These were all things I'd been thinking about throughout the long day, that somewhere out there were wives and children whose husbands and fathers were never coming home again, who would never know what had happened to them. Should I gather their personal effects, minus their ghastly remains, and ship them anonymously to the police department? I understood the grim comfort of knowing for a fact that Alina was dead, of having seen her body and laid her in the ground. If she had simply disappeared, I'd have gone through every day of the rest of my life driven by an unquenchable, desperate hope, searching every face in every crowd, wondering if she was alive out there somewhere, praying she wasn't in the hands of some psycho.
Tomorrow, said Barron's, you'll go to the National Museum.
I hadn't realized I was holding my breath, hoping for an answer that might assuage some of the guilt I'd been stewing in, until it came out in a derisive snort. Typical Barron's. Ask for an answer, get an order. What happened to, you will remain here until I return, Miss Lane? I mocked. What about Malouche and his men? Have you forgotten about that little problem? O'Banion might be gone, and I might have a way of protecting myself from the Fae, but there was still one very pissed-off vampire on the loose out there.
Malouche was summoned away last night by someone whose orders he apparently could not or would not refuse. His followers expect him to be gone for several days, perhaps as long as a week," said Barons.
My battered spirits lifted a little. That meant, for a few days at least, I could venture out into the city and move about almost like a normal person again, with only the Fae to worry about. I wanted to go back to Alina's apartment and decide just how much damage I was willing to inflict on it to further my search for her journal. I wanted to buy more snacks for my room, in case I got stuck up there again. And I'd been itching to pick up a cheap sound dock for my iPod. Earbuds were fast becoming a thing of my past. I was turning into too paranoid a person to stand not being able to hear the approach of whatever might jeopardize my life next. But at least I could listen to music in my room if I had a sound dock, and since I was saving money by not paying for a room anymore, I'd neatly justified the purchase. Why am I going to the museum?
I want you to scour it for oops, as you call them. I've long wondered if there are Fae artifacts being hidden in plain view, catalogued as something else. Now that I have you, I can test that theory.
Don't you know what all the oops are, and what they look like? I asked. He shook his head.
If only it were that simple. But not even the Fae themselves recall all their own relics.
He gave a short, dark laugh.
I suspect it comes from living too long. Why bother to remember or keep track of things? Why care? You live today. You'll live tomorrow. Humans die. The world changes. You don't. Details, Miss Lane, he said, go the way of emotions in time.
I blinked. Huh?
The Fae, Miss Lane, he said. They aren't like humans. Extraordinary longevity has made them something else. You must never forget that.
Believe me, I said. I wasn't about to mistake them for human. I know they're monsters, even the pretty ones. His eyes narrowed.
The pretty ones, Miss Lane. I thought all the ones you've seen so far were ugly. Is there something you're not telling me?
I'd almost slipped about Vlaine, a topic I had no desire to discuss with Barons. Until I knew who I could trust, if anyone, and how far, I would keep my own counsel about some things. Is there something you're not telling me? I countered coolly. How dare he poke at me for keeping secrets when he was chock full of them? I didn't bother trying to hide that I was trying to hide something. I just used one of his methods on him, evasion by counter-question. We had another of those wordless communiques, this time about truths and deceptions and bluffs and calling people on them, and I was getting better at reading him because I saw the very moment Barons decided pushing me wasn't worth giving up anything himself.
Try to wrap the museum up as quickly as possible,
he said.
After you've finished there, we've a list of places longer than your arm in and about Ireland to search for the remaining stones and the Shisadu.
Oh, God, this is my life now, isn't it? I exclaimed. You expect me to just trudge around from place to place as you select them, with my nose pressed to the ground, sniffing out oops for you, don't you?
Have you changed your mind about trying to find the Shisadu, Miss Lane?
Of course not, I said.
Do you know where to look yourself?
I scowled. We both knew I didn't.
Don't you think the surest way to find both the Dark Book and your sister's killer is to immerse yourself in the very world that killed her?
Of course I did. I'd thought of that all by myself last week. So long as that world doesn't kill me first, I said. And it certainly seems to be trying its darndest. He smiled faintly.
I don't think you understand, Miss Lane. I won't let it kill you, no matter what.
He stood and walked across the room. As he opened the door, he shot over his shoulder,
"And one day you will thank me for it."
Was he kidding? I was supposed to thank him for staining my hands with blood? I don't think so, Barons, I told him, but the door had already swung closed, and he disappeared into the rainy Dublin night. 18. Shades, perhaps my greatest enemy among the Fae, I wrote in my journal. Dropping my pen between the pages, I checked my watch again. Still 10 more minutes to go until the museum opened. If I'd had bad dreams last night, and I'd been so eager to get out of the bookstore and into the sunny morning, to go do something touristy and refreshingly normal, that I hadn't thought to check what time the museum opened. After stopping for coffee and a scone, I'd still arrived a half an hour early, and was one of many people milling outside, standing in groups or waiting on benches near the domed entrance of the Museum of Archaeology and History on Kildare Street. I'd managed to snag a bench for myself, and was making good use of my extra time by updating recent events in my notebook and summarizing what I'd learned. My obsession with finding Alina's journal was shaping what and how I chose to write in my own, about everything, and in great detail. Hindsight was 20/20, and you never knew what clues someone else might be able to pick up on in your life that you were blinded to by living it. If anything happened to me, I wanted to leave behind the best possible record I could, in case someone else would take up my cause, although, frankly, I couldn't imagine anyone who would, and I hoped Alina had done the same. I picked up my pen. According to Barron's, I wrote, the shades lack substance, which means I can neither freeze nor stab them. It appears I have no defense against this low-level cast of Unseelie. The irony was not lost on me. The shades were the most base of their kind, barely sentient, yet, despite the spearhead in my purse, tip securely cased in a wad of foil, allegedly capable of killing even the most powerful shark in the Fey Sea, I was still helpless against the bottom feeders. Well, I was just going to have to stay off the bottom then, and arm myself tooth and nail with what did work against them. I jotted a quick addition to a shopping list I'd been compiling, several dozen flashlights in varying sizes. I would begin carrying 2 or more on me at all times and scatter the rest around the bookstore, in every corner of every room, bracing for the horrifying possibility that the power might one night go out. Despite the bright morning sun, I shivered, just thinking about it. I'd not been able to get the shades off my mind ever since yesterday when I'd discovered those piles of clothing collapsed around their papery remains. "Why do they leave clothing behind?" I'd asked Barron's when I'd passed him in the rear hall late last night on my way to bed. The man was a serious night owl. At my tender age, in my defense, I'd like to point out that I've had a very stressful life lately. I'd been bleary-eyed and exhausted by 1 in the morning, yet he'd looked disgustingly energized and awake, and in high spirits again. I knew my question was hardly important in the overall scheme of things, but sometimes it's the tiniest, insignificant details that nag at my curiosity the most.
"In the same way the gray man hungers for beauty that will never be his, Miss Lane," Barron's had said, "the shades are drawn to steal that which they can never possess as well, a physical manifestation of life. So they take ours and leave behind what has no animation. Clothing is inert."
"Well, what are those papery things?" I'd asked, gripped by a revolting fascination. "I'm assuming they're parts of us, but which ones?"
"Morbid tonight, are we, Miss Lane? How would I know?"
Barron's shrug was a Gallic ripple of muscle beneath crimson silk.
"Perhaps condensed skin, bones, teeth, toenails and such, sucked dry of life. Or perhaps our brains are unpalatable to them. Maybe they taste like frog, Miss Lane, and shades hate frog."
"Ugh," I muttered, as I scribbled the gist of our nocturnal conversation on a new page. While I was finishing up, there was a sudden mass exodus around me, and I glanced up at the now open doors of the museum. Tucking my journal carefully into my purse so it didn't hamper easy access to my spearhead, I slung my bag over my shoulder and rose, pleased to realize I was barely registering the nausea caused by such close contact with the oop. I was determined to carry the thing with me everywhere, so I'd forced myself to sleep with it last night, hoping the more contact I had with it, the less disturbing I would find it over time. It seemed to be working. My mood perked up as I stepped into the grand rotunda entrance. I've always liked museums.
I should probably pretend it's because I'm so erudite and scholarly and love to learn, but the truth is I just love shiny, pretty things, and from what I'd heard about this place, it was packed full. I couldn't wait to see them. Unfortunately, I wasn't going to get very far. One day I would stop taking off my clothes in Blaine's presence, but the cost of that resistance would be a piece of my soul. Today, here and now, strolling through the National Museum of Archaeology and History, dazzled and delighted by the ore exhibit, a treasure trove of Ireland's gold, I had no idea that pieces of one's soul could be lost. Back then I was so blind to everything that was going on around me. Back then I was 22 and pretty, and up until the month before, my biggest concern had been whether Revlon would discontinue my favorite iceberry pink nail polish, which would be a disaster of epic proportions as it would leave me without the perfect complement for the short pink silk skirt I was wearing today, with a clingy, pearly top, and shimmery gold sandals, flattered by just the right heel to show off my golden-toned legs. A polished pearl-drop necklace swung between my full breasts, matching earrings and a pearl bracelet at my wrist gave me just the right look of youthful glam. My Arabian Nights curls were soft around my face, and I was turning more than a few male heads. I notched my chin a bit higher and smiled inside. Ah, the simple pleasures in life! A few display cases down, over by the stairs, a really cute guy was checking me out. He was tall, athletically built, with short dark hair, great skin, and the dreamiest blue eyes ever. He looked to be about my age, maybe a few years older, a college student, I was willing to bet, and he was exactly the kind of guy I'd have gone out with back home. He gave me an appreciative nod and a smile, making his interest plain. "Distinguish yourself," my mom had told Alina and me. In an age where girls often make themselves too available to boys, by making him work a little for your attention. He'll think he's won a prize when he gets it, and he'll work that much harder to keep it. Boys turn into men, and men put a premium on what's hardest to get. Have I mentioned what a wise woman my mother is? My dad is still head over heels for her after 30 years, still thinks the sun rises and sets on Rainy Lane's head, and if one day she didn't get out of bed, neither would the morning. And neither would he. Alina and I never lacked for love, but we always knew our parents loved each other a little bit more. We found it disgusting and at the same time reassuring that they never stopped locking us out of the bedroom at the weirdest times of day, sometimes twice in the same day. We'd roll our eyes at each other, but in a world where the divorce rate is more alarming than oil prices, their ongoing love affair was our Rock of Gibraltar. I started to give the guy a demure smile, but the moment my lips began to curve, they froze. Why bother? It wasn't as if dating was something I could schedule neatly in, right between vampires, life-sucking fae, mobsters, and oop-detecting. Would he come pick me up at Barron's for our date? Gee, what if my enigmatic and cold-blooded host chose that night to turn off the outside lights again? Bye-bye, cute boy. Hello, pile of clothes. That thought iced the blood in my veins. I stepped up my pace and left the boy behind in a hurry. Continuing through the exhibit, I focused on my recently discovered raison d'etre, stretching my spidey sense in all directions, waiting for a tingle. I got nothing. I moved through room after room, past artifact after relic, display after display, without getting the faintest twinge of nausea. I was, however, getting a few other twinges. Apparently the cute boy had stirred up my hormones, because I was suddenly having downright kinky thoughts about him and wondering if he had a brother, or two, maybe even three. That was so not me. I'm a one-man woman. Even in my fantasies I tend to go for good old-fashioned steamy sex, not multi-partnered porn. A particularly graphic image of cute boy plus brothers swam up in my mind, and I nearly staggered from the raw eroticism of it. I shook my head sharply and reminded myself what I was doing here, looking for oops, not orgiastic mindless sex.
I'd nearly given up hope of encountering anything of interest when my gaze was drawn to a scrap of pink silk and lace lying on the floor a few feet away to my left, back in the direction from which I'd come. I couldn't help but think how pretty it was, and walked back over toward it to see what it was. My cheeks flamed. Of course I'd liked it. It was my panties. I snatched them up and performed a hasty inventory of myself. Skirt, check. Shirt, check. Bra on, good. Thank you, God. Apart from the draft on my bare bottom and the excruciatingly painful state of arousal I was in, I seemed to be okay. Apparently I'd gone straight to the panties, reached beneath my skirt, slipped them off, and continued walking without even noticing. If I weren't so enamored of pink, if I weren't so into fashion, I might have continued blithely disrobing, thinking all kinds of happy, horny thoughts, until I'd have been strolling the museum naked. As it was, I'd been sidetracked by the vision of my own good taste lying there on the floor. I wasn't sure if I should be relieved or appalled by how shallow I was. "Where are you?" I snapped, stepping back into my panties and smoothing my skirt down over my hips. Though I stood in the middle of a large room full of people exclaiming over various treasures, not one person was paying me the slightest bit of attention. There was no doubt in my mind what had just brought me to such an intense, base state of sexual arousal that I'd begun subconsciously stripping. A fae was here somewhere, glamouring things up, and it was one of the death-by-sex ones. I assumed it was Blaine, mostly because the thought that there might be multiple terrifyingly beautiful mind-bending libido-distorting fae in my world was more than I could handle. From somewhere behind me, laughter rolled like smooth, round, cool pearls sliding slowly over my clitoris, and I was suddenly a great, bottomless abyss of excruciating sexual need. My legs were shaking, my panties were gone again, my inner thighs were soaking wet, and I was so hungry for sex that I knew for a fact I was going to die if I didn't get it right here and now. A clatter drew my gaze to the floor. Next to my panties was my pearl bracelet. I wasn't sure if I'd done what I'd just felt between my legs or if it had. "Blaine," I whispered, through lips swollen and plumped, just like my breasts were swelling and plumping. My body was changing, making itself ready for its master, growing softer and wetter and riper and fuller.
"Lie down, human,"
it said. "Over my dead body, Fay," I snarled. It laughed again, and my nipples were on fire.
"Not yet, She-Seer, but one day you might beg for death."
Anger. That was it. Anger had worked before. Anger and another A-word. But what was it, that word? What had saved me before? What was that unhappy thought, that miserable thought that could make me go cold inside and feel like death myself? "Apple," I muttered. No, that wasn't it. "Artifact. Adam. Alleged. Allowed. Wasn't I? Allowed to have sex right here and now? Hadn't it said, 'Lie down, human'? Who was I to disobey?" I knelt on the cool marble floor of the museum and slipped my skirt up over my hips, bearing, presenting. "Here I am. Take me."
"On all fours,"
it said behind me, laughing again, and again I felt the cool slip of pearls being dragged slowly between my thighs, over my taut bud, between my swollen, slick lips. I dropped forward on my hands and knees. My spine arched, my bottom lifted, and I made a sound that wasn't at all human. My mind was going. I could feel it, and I still didn't even know if it was Blaine behind me or some other fae that was going to nail me to the floor and slowly screw me to death. Then its hands were on my bottom, and it was positioning me. And if I was a null, I'd forgotten I had hands, and if there was a spear nearby, I'd forgotten I had a purse, and if I'd once had a sister who'd been killed somewhere in Dublin, Alina! The word exploded from me with such vehemence and desperation that spittle sprayed from my lips. I wrenched myself free, reared around, and slammed both palms into Blaine's chest. "You pig!" I scuttled sideways, a bare-bottomed crab, desperate to reach the purse I dropped several yards away, along with my shirt and shoes. By the time I reached my small pile of abandoned possessions, the Fae was already unfrozen again. Barons had been right. The higher the caste, the more powerful the Fae. Apparently, I could only freeze royalty for mere moments. It wasn't enough, not nearly enough.
"We are not pigs,"
it said coldly, rising.
"It is humans who are the animals."
"Yeah, right. I'm not the one that almost just raped me."
"You wanted it, and you still do,"
it said flatly.
"Your body burns for me, human. You want to worship me. You want to be on your knees."
The horror of it was right. I did. Even now, my back was still arched with sensual invitation. My bottom was questing up like a cat in heat, and my every move was supple, sinuous. I was one great big come-hither. There was a mindless nymphomaniac inside me, and it didn't care how many orgasms it took to die. With trembling hands, I grabbed my purse. "Stay away from me," I warned. Its expression said it was in no hurry to get close to me at the moment. Its expression said it was revolted by my all-too-brief power over it, by a mere human having dominion in any manner over something so glorious as itself.
"Why have you come here? What of ours is here, Shisir?"
it demanded. Unzipping my purse, I nudged the ball of foil from the tip and closed my hand on the spear, but left it tucked inside. I wanted to preserve the element of surprise. "Nothing."
"You lie."
"No, really, there's nothing here," I said truthfully, not that I would have told it if there had been.
"It has been 5 days, Shisir. What did you take from O'Banion?"
I blinked. How in the world did it know that?
"He died trying to get it back, that's how. I know where you stay,"
it said.
"I know where you go. It is useless to lie to me."
I preferred to believe the Fae had read the thoughts on my face, not plucked them from my mind. I bit my tongue to keep from whimpering. It was doing something to me again. It had my pearls again, and it was working between my legs with them, one hard, cool ball after the next.
"Talk, Shisir."
"You want to know what we took? I'll show you what we took." I curled my fingers tightly around the base of the spearhead, yanked it from my purse, and drew it back threateningly. "This!" It was the first time I ever saw such a look on a Fae's face, and it would not be the last. It filled my veins with such a heady rush of power that it was very nearly equal to the insane sexual arousal I was feeling. Blaine, Prince of the Tuatha De Dananna, feared something. And it was in my hand. The imperious Fae was gone, just like that. Blink of an eye, if I'd blinked. I hadn't. He'd vanished. I sat, breathing deeply, clutching the spear, and trying to regroup. The room seeped slowly back into my consciousness, a buzz of noise, a blur of color, and finally snippets of conversation here and there.
"What do you suppose she's doing?" "No idea, man, but she's got a great ass, and talk about your tits to die for."
"Cover your eyes, Donnie, no!" A mother's tight, pinched voice. "She's not decent."
"Looks better than decent to me."
Accompanied by a low whistle and the flash of a camera.
"What the hell is in her hand? Should somebody call the cops?" "I don't know, maybe the paramedics. She doesn't look so well."
I glanced around, wild-eyed. I was on the floor, surrounded by people on all sides, a circle of them, pressing in on me, staring down at me with greedy, curious eyes. I sucked in a ragged breath that wanted to come back out as a sob, crammed the spear back in my purse. How in the world would I explain having it? Yanked my skirt back down over my bottom, clasped my bra over my bare breasts, fumbled for my shirt, yanked it over my head, picked up my shoes and scrambled to my feet. "Get out of my way!" I cried, plunging blindly into the crowd, shoving them aside, vultures one and all. I couldn't help it. I burst into tears as I raced from the room. For such an old woman, she sure could move fast. She cut me off less than a block away from the museum, darting in front of me, blocking my path. I veered sharply left and detoured around her without missing a beat.
Stop! She cried. Go to hell! I snapped over my shoulder, tears scalding my cheeks. My victory over Vlaine with the spear had been completely overshadowed by my public humiliation. How long had I been sitting there with parts of me sticking out that no man had ever gotten a good look at in broad daylight unless armed with a speculum and a medical license? How long had they been watching me? Why hadn't someone tried to cover me up? Down south, a man would have draped a shirt around me. He would have taken a quick glance while he did it. I mean, really, breasts are breasts and men are men. But chivalry is not entirely dead where I come from. Voyeurs, I said bitterly. Sick, scandal-starved people. Thank you, reality TV. People were so used to being taken straight into other people's most intimate moments and viewing the sordid details of their lives that they were now far more inclined to sit back and enjoy the show than make any effort to help someone in need. The old woman got in front of me again, and I veered right this time, but she veered with me, and I crashed into her. She was so elderly and tiny and fragile-looking that I was afraid she might topple over, and at her age a fall could mean serious broken bones and a long recovery period. Good manners, unlike those creeps in the museum, some of us still had them, temporarily eclipsed my misery, and I steadied her by the elbows. What? I demanded. What do you want? You want to bean me in the head again? Well, go ahead. Do it and get it over with. But I think you should know that I couldn't help seeing this one, and the situation is, well, it's complicated. My assailant was the old woman from the bar that first night I'd arrived in Dublin, the one who'd rapped me with her knuckles and told me to stop staring at the Fay and go die somewhere else, and, although now I knew she'd saved my life that night, she might have done it more nicely. I was currently in no mood to thank her. Tilting her silvery white head back, she stared up at me, a flabbergasted expression on a wrinkled face.
"Who are you?"
she exclaimed. "What do you mean, who am I?" I said sourly. "Why are you chasing me if you don't know who I am? Do you make a habit of chasing strangers?"
"I was in the museum," she said. "I saw what you did. Sweet Jesus, Mary, Mother of God, and all the saints, who are you, lass?"
I was so disgusted with people in general that I shrieked, "You saw what that thing was trying to do to me and didn't try to help me? If it had raped me, would you have just stood there and watched? Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Gee, it's getting to the point where I'm not sure who the bigger monsters are, us or them." I spun sharply and tried to walk away, but she latched onto my arm with a surprisingly strong grip.
"I couldn't help you, and you know it," she snapped. "You know the rules."
I shook her hand off my arm. Actually, I don't. Everyone else seems to, just not me.
"One betrayed is one dead," said the old woman sharply. "Two betrayed is two dead. We count precious each of our kind, never more so than now. We cannot take risks that might betray more of us, especially not me. Besides, you held your own in a way I've never seen. And against a prince, no less. Sweet Jesus, how did you do it? What are you?"
Her sharp blue gaze darted rapidly from my left eye to my right and back again.
"At first your hair fooled me. Then I knew it was you from the bar. That skin, those eyes, and the way you walk. Ugh, just like the Patrona. But you can't be Patronas, or I'd have known. From what O'Connor line do you come? Who is your mother?" she demanded.
I tossed my head impatiently. "Look, old lady, I told you that night in the bar I am not an O'Connor. My name is Lane, Michaela Lane, from Georgia. My mom is Rainy Lane, and before she married my dad, she was Rainy Fry. So there you have it. Sorry to disappoint you, but there's not a single O'Connor anywhere in my family tree."
"Then you were adopted," the old woman said flatly.
I gasped. "I was not adopted."
"Bollocks," the old woman snapped. "Though I've no notion the hows and whys of it, you're an O'Connor through and through."
"The nerve," I exclaimed. "How dare you come up to me and tell me I don't know who I am?
I'm Michaela Lane, and I was born in Christ Hospital, just like my sister. And my dad was right there in the room with my mom when I was born, and I am not adopted, and you don't know the first thing about me or my family.
Obviously, the old woman retorted. You don't, either.
I opened my mouth, thought better of it, shut it, and turned and walked away. I would only be giving credence to the old woman's delusions by rebutting them. I wasn't adopted, and I knew that for a fact, as certainly as I knew she was one crazy old woman.
Where are you going? She demanded. There are things I must know. Who you are, if we can trust you, and how, by all that's holy, did you get your hands on one of their hallows? That night in the bar I thought you were pariah.
She spat the word like the foulest of epithets.
From the moonstruck way you were staring at it. Now I've no idea what you are. You must come with me now. Stop right there, O'Connor.
She used a tone of voice that not so long ago would have stopped me dead in my tracks and turned me around, out of respect for my elders, if nothing else. But I wasn't that girl any more. In fact, I was no longer even certain who that girl had really been, as if Mac BTC, before the call that day by the pool, hadn't quite been real, just an empty, pretty amalgam of fashionable clothes, happy music, and cultish dreams.
"Stop calling me that," I hissed over my shoulder, "and stay away from me, old woman."
I broke into a sprint but wasn't fast enough to outrun her next words, and I knew as soon as she said them that they were going to chafe like sharp pebbles in my shoes.
"Then ask her,"
rang out the old woman's challenge.
"If you're so certain you're not adopted, Michaela Lane, talk to your mother and ask her."
19. "What's on the agenda tonight?" I asked Barons the moment he stepped into the bookstore. I'd been pacing near the front windows with all the lights blazing, both interior and exterior, watching as night fell beyond the illuminated fortress. I guess my tone was a little tight, because he raised a brow and looked at me hard.
"Is something wrong, Miss Lane?"
"No, not at all. I'm fine. I just wanted to know what I have to look forward to tonight," I said. "Robbing somebody we get to let live, or somebody we have to kill?" I sounded brittle even to myself, but I wanted to know just how much worse a person I was going to be by tomorrow morning. Every day I looked in the mirror, it was getting harder to recognize the woman looking back at me. Barons paced a slow circle around me.
"Are you sure you're all right, Miss Lane? You seem a little tense."
I rotated at the center, turning with him. "I'm just ducky," I said. His eyes narrowed.
"Did you find anything at the museum?"
"No."
"Did you search every exhibit?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"I didn't feel like it," I said.
"You didn't feel like it."
For a moment, Barons looked perfectly blank, as if the idea that someone might disobey one of his orders just because they didn't feel like it was even more inconceivable to him than the possibility of human life on Mars. "I am not your workhorse," I told him. "I have a life, too. At least I used to. I used to do perfectly normal things like date and go out to eat and see movies and hang out with friends and never once think about vampires or monsters or mobsters. So don't go getting all over my case because you think I haven't performed up to your exacting standards. I don't plan your days for you, do I? Even an oop detector needs a break every now and then." I gave him a disgusted look. "You're lucky I'm helping you at all, Barons." He closed in on me and didn't stop until I could feel the heat coming off his big, hard body, until I had to tilt my head back to look up at him, and when I did, I was taken aback by his glittering midnight eyes, the velvety gold of his skin, the sexy curve of his mouth, with that full lower lip that hinted at voluptuous carnal appetites, and the upper one that smacked of self-control and perhaps a bit of cruelty, making me wonder what it would be like. Whoa! I shook my head sharply, trying to clear it. From my two brief encounters with Blaine, I knew that merely being in the same general vicinity with a death by sex fae caused an extreme hormonal spike in a woman that did not go away until it was released somehow. What Blaine had done to me today had left me so awfully, icily aroused that it had taken more orgasms than I'd thought possible to have and a long, frigid shower to calm me. And now it seemed I hadn't done a good enough job, because I was still suffering residual effects. There was no other way to explain why I was standing there wondering what it would be like to kiss Jericho Barons. Fortunately, he chose that moment to open the mouth I'd been finding so disturbingly sexual and began speaking. His words abruptly restored my perspective.
"You still think you can walk away from this, don't you, Miss Lane?"
he said coolly.
"You think this is about finding a book? You think it's about figuring out who killed your sister? But the truth is, your world is going to hell in a handbasket, and you're one of the few people that can do something about it. If the wrong person or thing gets its hands on the Shisadu, you won't be ruined the loss of your rainbow-hued, prettily manicured world. You'll be regretting the end of human life as you know it. How long do you think you'll last in a world where someone like Malouche or the Unseelie who's got his rhino boy watchdog stationed all over the city gets the dark book? How long do you think you'll want to? This isn't about fun and games, Miss Lane. This isn't even about life and death. This is about things that are worse than death."
"Do you really think I don't know that?" I snapped. Maybe I hadn't been talking about everything he'd just said, but I'd sure been thinking about it. I knew there was a bigger picture going on out there than just what had been happening to me in my little corner of the world. I'd eaten ketchup-soaked fries and watched the Gray Man destroy a helpless woman, and I'd wondered every night since who was falling victim to him now. I'd gotten an up-close look at the many-mouthed thing's many mouths and knew it was out there somewhere, feeding on someone. I'd wondered, if I could jump forward in time a year or two, what Dublin would look like then. I had no doubt the dark territory of the abandoned neighborhood was expanding even as Barons and I spoke, that somewhere out there another street lamp had fizzled, emitting a final, weak flicker of light before burning out, and the shades had instantly slithered in around it, and tomorrow, according to Barons, the city wouldn't even remember that block had ever existed. Such worries weren't just on my waking mind. They were invading my dreams. Last night I'd had a nightmare in which I'd been floating over a Dublin that was pitch black, except for a single blazing four-story stronghold in the middle of it. In the surreal manner of dreams, I'd been both above the city and down inside the store, looking out the front door. So much of Dublin had fallen to darkness that I'd known, even if I'd begun walking the instant the morning sun crested the horizon, I wouldn't be able to make it to another lighted sanctuary before nightfall, and that I was stuck at Barron's Books and Baubles for the rest of my life. I'd woken up thinking about things like prophetic dreams and apocalypses instead of entertaining my usual blissful early morning thoughts of what I was going to eat that day and what pretty outfits I might wear. Oh, yes, I knew this was about worse things than death. Like being expected to go on living after your sister was killed. Like watching everything you believed about yourself and the world in general get unveiled as one great big fat lie. But the big picture going on out there wasn't my problem. I'd come to Dublin to find Alina's killer, get whatever justice I could, then go home. And that's what I still planned to do. O'Banion was no longer a threat, and maybe out of sight was out of mind for Malouche. Maybe Barons could save the city from the Fae. Maybe the Queen, if anything Blaine had said was true, would find the Dark Book without my help just fine, send the Unseelie back to prison, and our world would go back to normal. Maybe after I left, all the evil things hunting the Shisadu would fight themselves to death over it. There were a great many possibilities, and none of them had to involve me. I was sick of this place. I wanted out before one more strand of reality unraveled around my ears.
"Then what's with the attitude?"
Barons demanded.
"And why didn't you finish at the museum?"
"I had a bad day today, okay?" I said coolly, though inside I felt like a volcano about to blow at any moment. "Isn't everybody entitled to one now and then?" He searched my face for a long moment, then shrugged.
"Fine. Finish up tomorrow."
I rolled my eyes. "So what are we doing tonight?" He gave me a faint smile.
"Tonight, Miss Lane, you learn how to kill."
I know what you're wondering. I'd be wondering it, too. Did I call my mom? I'm neither that stupid nor that insensitive. She was still reeling from the shock of Alina's death, and I wasn't about to upset her more. Still, I had to prove the old biddy wrong. So after I left the museum and stopped at a hardware store for a cache of flashlights, I'd made a beeline back to Baron's Books and Baubles so I could call the hospital where I'd been born and lay the old woman's ridiculous claim to rest. One great thing about small towns is that the people are so much more helpful than they are in big cities. I think it's because they know the person on the other end of the line is somebody they might run into at their kid's softball practice on Tuesday or at Wednesday night bowling league or one of the town's many church picnics and festivals. After being transferred half a dozen times and put on hold a few more, I finally got through to the woman in charge of the records department, Eugenia Patsy Bell, and she was just as nice as could be. We chatted for a few moments, during which I learned I'd gone to high school with her niece.
This is the end of disc number 6. Please continue listening on disc number 7. This is disc number 7.
After being transferred a half a dozen times and put on hold a few more, I finally got through to the woman in charge of the records department, Eugenia Patsy Bell, and she was just as nice as could be. We chatted for a few moments, during which I learned I'd gone to high school with her niece, Chandra Bell. I told her what I was looking for, and she told me yes, they kept both paper and electronic files on every berth in the hospital. I asked if she could find mine and read it to me over the phone. She said she was terribly sorry, but she wasn't allowed to do that. But if I could confirm some personal information, she could pull it up right now on her computer, print it off, and get it out to me in the afternoon mail. I gave her Barron's address and was just about to hang up, when she asked me to hold on a moment. I sat on the other end of the line, listening to her tap away at her keyboard. She asked me to reconfirm my information twice, and I did so, each time with a growing sense of dread. Then she asked if she could put me on hold one more time while she went and checked the physical files. It was a long hold, and I was glad I'd made the call on the bookstore's phone. Then Eugenia came back and said, "Wasn't it just the darndest thing?" She couldn't explain it, because she knew for certain their records were complete. Their database went all the way back to the early 1900s and was painstakingly maintained by none other than herself. And she was so sorry that she couldn't help me, but there was absolutely no record, electronic or otherwise, of a Michaela Lane born at Christ Hospital 22 years ago. "And no," she said when I pressed, "nothing 24 years ago for Alina Lane either. In fact, there was no record at all of any Lane born at Christ Hospital during the past 50 years. We couldn't find a single unsealy. We walked down street after street, went into pub after pub, but found nothing. There I was, armed with a fae-killing spear and a seriously bad attitude, only to be denied the chance to blow off some steam by taking out one of the monsters responsible for turning my life into the mess it was. Not that I was entirely certain I could have taken one of them out. Oh, I was pretty sure my head was in the right place. I just didn't know if my body would perform the way it was supposed to. I was pretty sure I was feeling the same thing a guy must feel before he proves himself in his first fist fight, wondering if he has what it takes to knock out his opponent, or if he'll humiliate himself by swinging like a girl, or worse, missing completely."
"That's why I brought you out tonight,"
Baron said when I told him my concerns.
"I'd rather you screw up while I'm with you, so I can manage the situation, than have you attempt your first kill on your own and get yourself killed instead."
I had no idea how prophetic his words would prove. Just a hard night's work, out protecting your investment, huh? I said dryly as we exited yet another pub filled with only people, no monsters. Sarcasm aside, I was glad he was along to save me if I needed saving. I might not trust Barons, but I'd developed a healthy respect for his ability to manage situations. So how am I supposed to do it? I asked. Is there some trick to this?
Just freeze it and stab it, Miss Lane. But do it fast. If it sifts you somewhere else, I won't be able to save you.
Is there any particular place I'm supposed to stab it? Assuming, of course, whatever we stumble across has the equivalent of human body parts. Were they like vampires? Was a direct hit to the heart necessary? For that matter, did they even have hearts?
The gut's always good.
I glanced down at my lavender shirt and short purple floral patterned skirt. The outfit went fabulously with my new darker do. Do they bleed?
Some of them. In a manner of speaking, Miss Lane.
He gave me a quick, dark flash of a smile that wasn't nice at all, and I knew right then and there that whatever came out of some of the unseelie was going to seriously gross me out.
You might try wearing black next time. Then again, we could always just hose you off back at the garage.
I scowled as we stepped into our 14th pub of the night. Don't any of them just poof? Wasn't that what monsters were supposed to do when you killed them? Disintegrate instantly into dust that promptly scattered on an opportune wind?
Poof, Miss Lane.
The bar we just entered featured a live band tonight and was jam-packed with people. I pushed into the crowd, following Barons' broad back. You know, vanish. Remove all need to waste time cleaning up or explain away inexplicable corpses littering the world, I clarified. He glanced back at me, one dark brow raised.
Where do you get your ideas?
I shrugged. Books and movies. You stake a vampire, it goes poof and disappears.
Really?
He snorted.
Life is rarely so convenient. The real world is considerably messier.
As he moved toward the bar in the center of the pub, he tossed over his shoulder.
And don't trust a stake to work on a vampire, Miss Lane. You'll be sorely disappointed, not to mention dead.
Well, then, how does a person kill a vampire? I asked his back.
Good question.
Typical Baron's answer. No answer at all. One of these days I was going to corner him with questions and not let him off the hook. One of these days when I didn't have so many other things on my mind. I shook my head and turned my attention to the people around me, searching faces, looking for the one that would waver and run like melting candle wax and betray the monster within. This time I wasn't disappointed. Barons saw it at the same time I did.
Over by the hearth, he said quietly.
My eyes narrowed and my hands curled into fists. Oh, yes, I'd like to kill this one. It would put an end to some of my nightmares. I see it, I said. What do I do?
Wait until it leaves. We don't fight our battles in public. Dead, its glamour fails. The whole bar would see its true form.
Well, maybe the whole bar should see its true form, I said. Maybe they should know what's going on and what's out there. Barons gave me a look.
Why? So they can fear things they can't do anything to defend themselves against? So they can have nightmares about monsters they can't see coming? Humans are of no use in this battle.
I pressed a hand to my mouth and concentrated on keeping my supper of microwave popcorn down. It felt like it was popping again in my stomach and the bag was about to blow. I can't stand here and watch this, I said. I didn't know if my sudden nausea was in reaction to the unseelie or to the sight of its victim.
It's almost over, Miss Lane. He's nearly done, in case you couldn't tell.
Oh, I could tell. The moment I'd spotted the gray man and his companion, I'd known he was nearly done. The woman the gaunt, 9-foot-tall monster was feeding off of had good bones, model-worthy bones, the kind that makes all the difference between a pretty face and an agency-quality one. Me, I have a pretty face. This woman had once been exquisitely beautiful. Now those great bones were all that was left of her, beneath a veneer of thin, pallid, sagging flesh. And still the ravaged woman was staring up at the leprous Unseelie with worship in her eyes. Even from here I could see the bloodshot jaundice of her whites from dozens of tiny exploded capillaries. I had no doubt that her teeth had once been pearly, but now they were gray and had a brittle, crumbling appearance. A small, vicious-looking, pus-filled sore had blossomed in the corner of her mouth, and there was another budding on her forehead. As she tossed her head, smiling flirtatiously up at her destruction, in her eyes a gorgeous blonde man. Two clumps of her hair fell out, one onto the floor, the other onto the shoe of a man standing behind her. The man glanced down, saw the tuft of scalp and hair on his shoe, and kicked it off his foot with a shudder. He took one look at the gray man's victim, grabbed his date's hand, and dragged her off through the crowd like he was fleeing the Black Plague. I looked away. I couldn't watch. I thought it just made them ugly. I thought it didn't feed on them until they died.
It usually doesn't.
It's killing her, Barons. We have to stop it. Even I heard the edge of hysteria in my voice. He spun me by my shoulders and shook me. His touch crackled through me like heat lightning.
Get a grip, Miss Lane. It's too late. We can't do anything for her now. That woman has no hope of recovering from what it has done to her. She's going to die. It's only a question of when. Tonight by the Grey Man, tomorrow by your own hand, or in a few weeks from a severe wasting disease doctors won't be able to identify or arrest by any means known to man.
I stared up at him. Are you kidding me? You mean even if the victim tries to go on with her life to whatever degree she can, she dies in time anyway?
If the Grey Man takes it this far, yes. It usually doesn't. It usually leaves its victims alive because it likes to revisit them, to savor their pain for a long time. Occasionally, however, it finds one so beautiful, it doesn't seem able to bear that she exists, so it kills her on the spot. At least she'll never have to look at herself in a mirror, Miss Lane. At least her sojourn in hell will be brief.
That's supposed to be a comfort, I cried. That it will be brief?
You underestimate the pricelessness of brevity, Miss Lane.
His eyes were ice, his smile colder.
What are you, all of 21, 22?
There was a tinkle of breaking glass, a dull thud like that of a body hitting the floor, and a collective gasp behind me. Barons looked over my shoulder. His arctic smile faded.
Oh, God, is she dead? A woman cried.
It looks like her face is rotting,
a man exclaimed, aghast.
Now, Miss Lane,
Barons ordered.
It's on the move, headed for the door. Go after it. I've got your back.
I tried to glance over my shoulder. I don't know if I wanted to make sure the woman was really no longer suffering, or if there's just some innate human instinct to look at dead people. It would certainly explain our funeral practices, not to mention all those rubberneckers clogging up the roads around Atlanta at the scenes of traffic accidents. But Barons caught my chin in his hand and forced me to look straight into his eyes.
Don't,
he barked.
The dead ones stick in your memory. Just go kill the fuck that did it.
Sounded like good advice to me. We left the pub. I followed the gray man and Barons followed me, a dozen paces behind. The last time I'd seen this Unseelie, I'd had long blonde hair. I doubted it would recognize me with my new look. It didn't know I was a she-seer or a null, or that I had the spear, so I figured my odds of killing were high if I could get close enough. Getting close enough, however, was going to be the problem. Inhumanly tall, it was also inhumanly fast. I was already sprinting to keep pace with it. In order to catch it, I was going to have to break into a run. It's a little hard to sneak up on an enemy at a full gallop, especially in heels.
It's getting away, Miss Lane,
Barons growled behind me. Do you think I don't know that? I snapped. It was nearly halfway down the block and seemed to have suddenly amped up its glamour repellent. Pedestrians were scattering in its wake, detouring wide out into the street. Abruptly, I had a clear view of it down the sidewalk, which was not good. I could hardly shadow something without any camouflage between us. I was going to have to make a dash for it. It stopped, turned around, and looked straight at me. I froze. I had no idea how it knew, but it knew I knew, and I knew it, and there was no point in faking.
"Bloody hell,"
I heard Barron's curse softly, followed by the scrape of steel on stone, the rustle of fabric, then silence behind me. We stared at each other, the gray man and I. Then it smiled with that awful mouth that used up half its tall, thin face.
"I see you, she."